Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Taylor Branch on the significance of a little-known speech Martin Luther King Jr. gave at Bowdoin College.
We will be able to emerge from the bleak and desolate midnight of man's inhumanity to man into the bright and glittering daybreak of freedom and justice.
Also today, we reflect on the 1963 March on Washington with civil rights activist Congressman John Lewis.
We all can make a contribution. We all can get in the way. We all can get in good trouble, necessary trouble, to change things.
And Duke Ellington's sacred music comes to Boston in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Lord, dear Lord of love.
All that coming up this hour on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tanya Mosley. In May of 1964, Martin Luther King Jr. visited Bowdoin College, a small liberal arts school in Maine that was far from the civil rights movement he was leading in the South. King spoke before a crowd that spilled out of the First Parish Church in Brunswick, Maine. He talked about the progress that the civil rights movement had made and how far it still had to go.
The hour is late. The clock of destiny is ticking out. And we must act now before it is too late. The shape of the world today does not afford America the luxury of an anemic democracy.
This recording captures King at the beginning of a year in his career which he would receive the Nobel Peace Prize and stand next to President Lyndon Johnson as Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Joining me now from Baltimore to talk about Dr. King is Taylor Branch. He is an author and historian who won a Pulitzer Prize for his book, Parting the Waters, America in the King Years. This was the first volume of a trilogy about Dr. King and the civil rights movement. Taylor Branch, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tanya. Nice to be here.
Listening to Dr. King's speech from Bowdoin in 1964, I have to say that I got pretty emotional listening to it because it feels so timely. He could be speaking to issues we're dealing with today. I'd love to know your reaction to it.
Well, I think that's one of the distinctive things about Dr. King is that he framed issues that most of us think are just pure segregation applying only to the South, but he framed them in language about democracy itself and the larger meaning of freedom. And the discipline and the respect for it. He almost never used purely racial terms. He talked about fulfilling the democratic experiment and the true inner meaning of freedom. So he put things in very, very large terms, almost always with one foot in the scriptures and another in the Constitution. So he gave both a spiritual and a secular base to the challenge of overcoming our differences.
One foot in the scripture and the other in the Constitution. At the time of the speech, we were entering the height of the civil rights movement. Can you tell us more about where Dr. King was in his career at that time?
Well, this is May 1964. He had just come from St. Augustine, Florida, and was about to go back there to jail. It has an interesting New England connection because the mother of the governor of Massachusetts, Mrs. Peabody, the mother of Endicott Peabody, the governor, was in jail in St. Petersburg. She went down there with her purse and her pearls and went to jail in one of the most violent areas that Dr. King served. And he came from St. Augustine up to give these speeches, including the one at Bowdoin, and then went back down there and went to jail with her, or actually she got out before he went in, but also in the same movement. And the overarching reality was that the Civil Rights Bill of 64 was being filibustered in the Senate all through May. It had been filibustered since February, the longest filibuster in American history. So this was the civil rights movement was up or down on the legislation to end segregation that the movement had been crusading for basically 10 years, ever since the Brown decision in 1954. So this was really a pivotal time for him personally, because he did say that St. Augustine was the scariest place he ever was until that time. And also politically, because the Civil Rights Bill of 64 was hanging in the balance.
I'm going to ask you questions about his Boston ties in just a moment, but I want to go back to that speech specifically at Bowdoin College. He talks about three attitudes towards equality: the extreme optimist who thinks that we've made meaningful strides in race relations. Then there's the extreme pessimist who thinks that we've only made minor strides in the area of race relations and that perhaps we're regressing. And then the realist, combining the truths of two opposites while avoiding the extremes of both. I'd love for you to talk a bit about this idea of the three attitudes that shaped Dr. King's mission and perhaps its meaning for us today.
That was a common theme in his speeches. And, of course, the really important thing about it is that the extreme attitudes on either side, that time will solve this, we don't need to get involved, things are getting better, and it's hopeless, don't get involved with it at all. What they have in common is that both of them say we don't really need to get involved because it's either hopeless or it's taking care of itself. So what they have in common is a way of avoiding the issue and not delving into it yourself. The middle road that Dr. King recommended, he said, is hard because it requires you to reach outside yourself and get involved with people and ideas that are not comfortable for you in a determination to overcome those gaps and differences and make justice and freedom real. So he was always plagued by that. He was plagued by people saying time will take care of it, and he would say, no, time is neutral. We can and have gone backwards in race relations in our history, and time is only what we make of it. And so there's that distinctive anguish in his voice, because he's very idealistic and he's talking about how our scriptures and the Constitution provide for a historic freedom to the world, and yet you hear all the anguish in his voice because he's realistic enough to know how much avoidance and how much hostility and how much fear there is across the racial lines that divided America then and still do today.
And you touched on that in his voice. I thought of it as a somber-sounding voice, but you characterize it in a different way. Let's play another piece of tape from Dr. King's speech at Bowdoin in 1964.
I'm convinced that we will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the vitriolic words and the violent actions of the bad people who will bomb a church in Birmingham, Alabama, but for the appalling silence of the good people. Human progress never rolls in on the wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts and the persistent work of dedicated individuals who are willing to be co-workers with God, and without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the primitive forces of social stagnation.
Taylor, this sounds like a direct message to Northerners at the time. Can you expound on that, and is that true?
Well, he spoke in the North more than he spoke in the South, simply because he could get more audiences there, and that's where he was raising money. Mm-hmm. And but he gave more or less that same message in the South, too, because there were plenty of people. The year before, his classic letter from Birmingham jail was written to Southern liberals in much the same language that you heard there, that they were sitting on the sidelines and that they were making excuses not to get involved, and they were saying that King may be right in principle, but it was wrong to demonstrate in Birmingham and that it made people uncomfortable. So he gave that kind of speech constantly. Now, he was headed toward the North with his movement itself, but the very next year, in 1965, but the excerpt that you've been playing are from 64, which was kind of the climactic year of legislation to address the segregation laws in the South.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk
about... There wasn't a single elected official in all the Confederate states, nobody in the Congress, and to my knowledge, no mayor who endorsed repealing the segregation law. So it really was a pretty solid phalanx. The first mayor who came out against them was Ivan Allen, my mayor in Atlanta. I'm from Atlanta, and that wasn't until the Civil Rights Bill was actually introduced and before Congress. So it was pretty daunting of the civil rights movement to tackle a region that was that uniformly committed to those segregation laws that prevented black people even from going into libraries and schools, and far beyond schools, and even churches, of course, when the movement had so few traditional tools in politics. They didn't have much money, they didn't have any newspapers, they didn't have an army or a police force, and they were largely invisible. So it was a pretty brave movement.
This is important history. I think many times when we reflect on that time in history, we just think about the accomplishments that have happened over time and not thinking about all of that that went into making those accomplishments happen. I'd love to talk with you a bit about his time in Boston. Dr. King got his PhD at Boston University in 1955 here. He met his wife Coretta here, and he formed a deep connection with Howard Thurman, the then dean of BU's Marsh Chapel. I'd love for you to share with us a bit about how those relationships here in Boston shaped Dr. King and his work ultimately.
Well, Howard Thurman was Dr. King's constant temptation. He admired him deeply. He loved his work. He loved the work of a lot of thinkers. He had profound relations with people as varied as Abraham Heschel, the Orthodox Jewish rabbi, and Thich Nhat Hanh, who's still international master teacher of Buddhist nonviolence from Vietnam. So he had a lot of kind of profound connections. But Howard Thurman was dean of the chapel up there, and for Dr. King, he would always be tempted to say, I want to go up there and have a job like Howard Thurman so I don't have to keep going to jail in St. Augustine.
Right.
I want to get off the front lines. But he could never quite do it. He could never, he was a conscience-driven person, and he could never quite leave the front lines of the movement. But he loved being there in Boston. He loved studying for his PhD. He loved the kind of life that it was kind of an ideal vacation for him to imagine himself being out of the movement and comfortable and living an intellectual life like Howard Thurman did.
His constant temptation, as you call it. What type of reception did he receive in Boston from both the white and the African-American community?
Well, the white community was mostly shock in the sense of, what are you doing here? This is Boston. We don't have any segregation laws here. Mm. The best way, an amusing way to get at it, was that the people around Dr. King invented a nickname for Elliot Richardson, who was the lieutenant governor, I believe, at the time, and who met Dr. King in 65 in Selma. And a number of people, including some martyrs, went south from the Boston area, James Reeb and Jonathan Daniels from the Boston area. But then Dr. King came straight from Selma to Boston. It was the first city that he tested out for a northern movement. That was dedicated to prove, he said, or to wake America up to the fact that the race issue was not and never had been purely sectional. And he tested Boston as the first of the northern cities, and he ultimately decided not to do it. I don't think because of the reaction of the white people. They called Elliot Richardson, by the way, I was with you in Selma, because every time they would start talking to him about problems and segregation and prejudice and economic inequality in Boston area, he would say, I was with you in Selma.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning he Richardson was comfortable being down there in Selma supporting Dr. King, but he was not comfortable talking about a potential movement of demonstrations on racial injustice in Boston.
When it comes to the black community specifically,
Boston was also divided, and that's ultimately, Dr. King tried out 7 cities, including Boston, but ultimately launched his northern movement to show that racial barriers were a national issue in Chicago in early 1966.
What was the divide among the African-American community?
well, quite frankly, when you get behind the scenes, the movement is personal, and the people there felt that it would reflect badly on them if he came there, because they wanted to project, they wanted, their official view was that they had race relations in pretty good hands. Mm. They thought it would reflect badly on their leadership if Dr. King came there to have marches and demonstrations to draw people's attention and try to change people's perspective on the way they looked at race relations in Boston, because he thought there was a complacency there. But he ultimately decided that the various groups there, the civil rights groups, the NAACP, the Urban League, the various leaders, and particularly the church leaders, were too divided and too resistant to the notion of his coming to Boston, because frankly it made it look like they needed his help, and they didn't like that.
He did come back here in 1965, and he led the civil rights march from the South End to the Boston Common, and he said, quote, "The vision of the new Boston must extend into the heart of Roxbury. Boston must be the testing ground for the ideals of freedom." So I'll tell you, like, I'm thinking about education,
that
housing.
That was the trip that he took to Boston, the first trip in 65.
So this was his first one that you were talking about.
That's right. It was within a month of Selma. Mm-hmm. It was like April 23rd, 1965, something like that.
How do you
think... The speech you just quoted.
Yes. How do you think, when we think about education and housing and wage and job disparities at the center of many of the discussions we're having today, how do you think Dr. King would view America's current climate?
Well, I think that he would say we haven't made a lot of progress on inner city segregation and displacement of jobs. Remember, he was talking about automation and job displacement and the fact that black workers who had migrated to the North after World War I and World War II for factory jobs were the first people to get displaced by automation. Now that kind of we call it globalization now, but now that's displacing even lawyers' jobs and middle-class jobs and Trump voters' jobs, who are insecure about work given international competition. But that's been a fact of life for black people who've been the first ones displaced and the first ones confined in certain areas of the city, you know, going back into the 19th century. So these are not new issues for Martin Luther King.
Let's listen to another moment from Dr. King's speech at Bowdoin in 1964.
The days are now difficult, the moments are now dark, but I still sing with those who are singing it by the thousands now in the theme song of our movement, "We Shall Overcome." And I believe this because somehow the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice.
We heard this same line from President Obama during his final address to the nation last week in Chicago. I'd love for you to talk for a moment about the significance of these words from both Dr. King and President Obama.
Well, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. King made that comment so many times that many people think it was his. He's actually quoting Theodore Parker, who was an abolitionist from New England. And President Obama quoted it because I think President Obama is equally devoted to the notion of democracy and justice and freedom being a long-range project. The American experiment was considered preposterous, that you know, we could get along in spite of our differences without a king or an army to order us about and tell us what to do. So Dr. King loved this quote, and he loved the fact that it was we, you know, "We shall overcome," which derives straight from "we the people," which is the fundamental optimism and groundedness of, you know, that's the first three words in the Constitution. So the interesting thing about the movement is that because people there lack traditional weapons to raise consciousness and move people to a higher plane on interracial relations, they had to stay up all night debating what roots they could find in the American tradition and how it would, where it would intersect with spiritual values and religious values in ways that would move people who were basically either didn't know about it or who were frightened about the idea of being engaged with black people at that time. So they went for very deep sources and very traditional sources, and it's not surprising that they would connect to the Ark of the Moral Universe, to a slogan from the abolitionist era, and to sayings from the American Revolution, and of course straight out of the Bible as well.
We are talking to Pulitzer Prize winning author of the trilogy detailing the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., America and the King Years. Thank you so much for joining us. It was a privilege to talk to you.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Radio Boston. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tanya Mosley. The 47th annual Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Breakfast was held at the Boston Convention and Exhibition Center this morning. The speakers included Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, Governor Charlie Baker, and Senators Elizabeth Warren and Ed Markey. WBUR's Shannon Dooling was at the event and joins us now. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, Tanya.
So this breakfast in Boston celebrating Dr. King is the longest running annual ceremony in the country. What was the vibe in the room like today?
That's right, Tanya. Many of the speakers recognized the history behind Boston's long-standing event. So there was certainly a sense of pride in the room around that tradition, but there was also a sense that this year's breakfast was different in some way. And of course, we're only a few days away from the inauguration of President-elect Trump. And quite frankly, he did not have many supporters in the room this morning. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the long list of elected officials who took to the stage, and that included Senator Elizabeth Warren, who really set the tone for the rest of the morning when she repeated the importance of causing, quote, necessary trouble. She said that over and over again in her remarks. She said that she was there to celebrate the civil rights movement, but that she's also focused on the fight that lies ahead.
Okay, so she said she's preparing for a fight. How did that resonate with the folks in the crowd?
Well, it resonated for sure. The message especially resonated when the audience was greeted by Senator Ed Markey. He took to the podium and he particularly hit this home. He began by asking rhetorically, what would Martin Luther King Jr. think about the state of our society today? And Markey's remarks really sort of soared from there.
Thank you all for what you are going to do. In Dr. King's name, God bless Dr. Martin Luther King. God bless his soul. God bless his good works.
And Tanya, I have to say, you can hear that applause there. I have to say, it felt as though the people in the room were craving that energy. It's like they were just waiting for that moment, that call to action. And when Markey delivered it, the crowd offered a standing ovation.
Well, in just a moment, we'll hear a bit of an interview from Congressman John Lewis, representative from Georgia and the civil rights activist who was one of the organizers of the 1963 March on Washington. As you know, on Friday, he was on NBC's Meet the Press, and Lewis said he doesn't, quote, see this president-elect as a legitimate president because of allegations that Russia was involved in the election. And Donald Trump went to Twitter saying that he should spend his time fixing his crime-infested district, talking to Lewis there, and that the representative is all talk and no action or results. Senator Warren had something to say about this. She talked about this to reporters.
She did. She was asked about it, and she hesitated as to whether or not she agreed with the congressman's remarks about the legitimacy of Trump's presidency. But she said that, you know what, after what Congressman Lewis has lived through, his life as a civil rights hero, really, he has earned the right to have a view of Donald Trump's presidency and legitimacy. And Warren went on to say that she believes there are plenty of questions around Russian involvement in the electoral process that need answering, and that unlike Congressman John Lewis, who does not plan to attend the inauguration on Friday, Warren will be there.
Thank you so much, Shannon Dooling, WBUR reporter. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, let's take a step back to look at John Lewis and the fight for equality. In 1963, Lewis was the youngest speaker on the March on Washington roster. He was 23 years old. At the time, he was the national chair of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
We are tired. We are tired of being beaten by policemen. We're tired of seeing our people locked up in jail over and over again. And then you holler, be patient. How long can we be patient? We want our freedom, and we want it now.
Congressman John Lewis spoke with Meghna Chakrabarty around the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington.
1963 was an unbelievable year. Hundreds and thousands of people had been arrested in jail. Bull Connor, the police commissioner in the city of Birmingham, had used dogs and fire hoses on people, little children, on women. We had to act. We had to do something. I remember the morning of August 28, 1963, before we made it to the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. We met with the leadership of the House, the leadership of the Senate, both Democrats and Republicans. And then we started walking down Constitution Avenue. We saw hundreds and thousands of people already marching. Now, we were supposed to be their leaders. It was almost like saying, there go my people. Let me catch up with them.
Congressman Lewis, you were the last living person who gave a speech that day. Is there any part of you that's concerned that there is a page turning now in American history past that moment of this great social upheaval when it came to equality or reaching for equality in America?
I'm deeply concerned that the present generation failed to grasp what happened. That's why I think it's so important for young people and those not so young to understand that there's a role for them to play. I have this feeling that people are just too quiet. They need to make some noise.
I saw you in a New York Times video a couple days ago. It was a companion to an article in the Times written about you. And when it comes to race in America, you said it's better now than it was in 1963. And that got me thinking, isn't that also what Chief Justice John Roberts was saying when he wrote that decision overturning key parts of the Voting Rights Act? Because I'm looking at his opinion, and he writes, our country has changed. While any racial discrimination in voting is too much, Congress must ensure that the legislation it passes to remedy that problem speaks to current conditions.
We have changed. We have made progress, but we changed. We made progress because of the Voting Rights Act. Without that act, we wouldn't be where we are today. But before the ink was dried on the paper, states like North Carolina, Texas, Arizona, Mississippi tried to take us back. I don't want to go back to the days of the literacy tests. When I spoke at the March on Washington, at least in that prepared text, I was reading a copy of the New York Times, and I saw a group of women in a photograph in the Times saying, one man, one vote. So I said, one man, one vote is the African cry. It is ours too. It must be ours. The vote is precious, almost sacred. It is the most powerful nonviolent instrumental tool that we have, and everybody should be able to use that tool. I know people who died for the right to vote.
You've got a new book out. It's a new memoir. It's the first of three parts. It's called March Book One, and you've chosen an interesting format to tell this story. What format have you chosen?
Well, we have decided to make it simple, make it plain, make it easier for young people and people not so young to understand what happened.
It's a graphic novel.
It's a graphic novel. And you can almost taste or feel or smell what is happening. You know, I talk about growing up, yes. Talk about my parents telling me, don't get in trouble, don't get in the way. And Dr. King and Rosa Parks inspired me to go out there and not just walk with the wind, but sail against the wind. To get arrested, the first time I got arrested, I felt free. I felt liberated. We all can make a contribution. We all can get in the way. We all can get in good trouble, necessary trouble, to change things.
So what is the unfinished work of August 28th, 1963?
That we must complete what we attempted to do during the 60s. Open up America, open up the society, and let everybody come in. and end discrimination based on race and color, nationality, sexual orientation, and create what I like to call one house, the American house. We all live in the same house. We're one family. We're one people.
Georgia Congressman John Lewis speaking to Meghna Chakrabarty back in 2013. I'm Tanya Mosley. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tanya Mosley. That's a live 1973 performance of Duke Ellington's Brotherhood. It's from Ellington's third sacred concert. While the sacred concerts are not as well known, Ellington considered the music, quote, the most important thing he had ever done. Boston-born musician Randall Keith Horton has dedicated his life to Ellington's sacred music. Horton was raised in Roxbury on what he calls a steady diet of faith and music. He sang doo-wop when he was young and worked as a hospital orderly. He went on to become a musician, scholar, conductor, and composing assistant to Ellington himself in the final year of Ellington's life. Horton is in town today with a special concert at Boston University in honor of Martin Luther King Day, featuring music from Ellington's sacred concerts. When we caught up with him last week from New York, he told us the extraordinary moment back in 1964 that changed his life. A beam of light that pulled him to music and eventually to Ellington.
It is the most profound and central experience of my musical life. I was in my little tiny apartment in Cambridge, actually. I had been working in the Peter Brigham Hospital. And I was in my apartment and literally, as a laser beam, a light came from above me, went inside of me, spoke to me, and said the exact words, go to San Francisco and study music.
Right then and there, Horton says, began his journey to becoming Duke Ellington's conductor and assistant.
The calling came, that light, in 1964. I left. My family was wondering, where is he going? What is he doing? But I left on the Greyhound bus. I got there in 1965, not even a year later, no, a little bit more than a year later, Maestro Ellington presented his first sacred concert at Grace Cathedral. I was in the audience, standing up against one of the big pillars because the cathedral was packed. And Maestro Ellington and I swapped glances. We just vibed on each other. That was the first contact. And I have to say that that same presence was there in that moment. The presence of that light was still there. And this might sound off the wall to some of your listeners, but this is the way it happened. This is the way it happened.
And so you all formed this relationship, and then from there he asked you to be his assistant.
As years went by, every time he came to San Francisco, I would be in the audience. I'd go up and shake his hand. I'd say hello. In 1973, so this is what, 9 years later, there I was standing in front of the Ellington Orchestra in Disneyland at his invitation, conducting my own music. And that, again,
at Disneyland, no less.
Can you imagine that?
Yes.
Yeah. The presence of that same light, I have to keep calling it that, was there at that time. And I wish I could say more, and I wish I could expand upon that for you, but I do want to make that as a central point, because that is the answer to your question. What brought me to him?
This music that you'll be conducting at Boston University is Ellington's sacred music, and you mention it when you first saw him at Grace Cathedral. What exactly is the sacred music of Duke Ellington?
It's the expression of his faith. He said, now I can say in public what I've been saying on my knees all my life. Much of the sacred music of Maestro Ellington is choral. And, you know, the public doesn't know Ellington as a choir or choral composer. No, he's a big band composer. Well, this has the big bands in it, of course, the first, second, and third sacred concerts, because that was his orchestra.
Well, let's hear some of that first sacred concert, the one you attended in 1965 at the Grace Cathedral in San Francisco. So you'll be conducting this music at Boston University, the sacred music. And Ellington often said that this was the most important thing he'd ever done, but it was also scandalous, the idea of bringing jazz music to the altar. Why do you think this music is not widely known?
The reason why he was rejected was that because, you know, Tanya, we as human beings see artists in certain genres, and we want them to stay in those genres. That's what happened to Maestro Ellington. He was in jazz, and people who were in the church, especially the black church, didn't see him as
someone who would be in the church, performing in the church.
Thank you. And then the jazz musicians. I mean, there are many of them, critics and so on, who did not like him doing what? Bringing this jazz sound where? Into the church. No. So that's what he went through. There was a lot of judgmental attitude, you know, a lot of judgmentalness that was involved with that. And people were saying things like, you know, he's been in the clubs all these years and in the service of the devil and all that. You know, I mean, people were incensed. It was incredible. And he was hurt. Now that music has become a world-class body of music.
Let's listen to the second sacred concert that took place in 1968 at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York. This is Too Good to Title, featuring Swedish singer Alice Babs. This music resonates very deeply with you. This is your life's work. Talk to me about the ultimate legacy of the sacred music in 2017, what you want listeners to listen for when they listen to this on Martin Luther King Day and beyond.
I want them to bring their own expectations to the concert with regard to how they perceive Duke Ellington. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, of course, he's a big band composer. He's a swinging composer. His music swings. He is the greatest exponent of the jazz era. And so we want to hear that. But what we won't expect, what we won't bring to the concert with us, is the music that we have never heard, which we will hear at the concert. You'll hear that band swinging. And the melody, anybody who knows the melody Come Sunday, Lord, dear Lord above, God Almighty, God of love, and so on. They will hear that melody from Come Sunday. Ooh, 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 ooh.
Let's take a listen to Come Sunday. We love your humming, but let's take
a
moment
that. Oh, good,
yes,
good,
we do.
Good.
God up above, please.
And of course, we love your humming, but that was the 1958 release of Come Sunday with Mahalia Jackson, which you
I'm
can't
sorry.
Beat that. You know?
No way. I'm so sorry.
No.
I didn't anticipate that. I'm sorry
no,
about that.
No, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. But no one can beat Mahalia Jackson,
that's correct.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, after Ellington's death, you worked with his family on the Concerto Grosso version of his work Black, Brown, and Beige. I'm wondering first if you could tell us the significance of the original Black, Brown, and Beige concert Ellington performed in 1943 at Carnegie Hall.
Ellington was a storyteller, and he was a private scholar. He not only read the Bible very frequently, but he also read literature that related to the African-American experience. He made the contribution through Black, Brown, and Beige in telling a story, a musical story, of the Middle Passage, Black, the first movement, the slaves coming to America, the second movement, Brown, with the slaves having just been emancipated, and then the third movement, Beige, with the former slaves now having been acculturated in the early 20th century. So the Harlem Renaissance, of which Ellington was the premier musical representative. So it's a historical piece. It's a piece that relates to the history of the African American. And as a matter of fact, the subtitle is A Tone Poem to the History of the American Negro.
Mm.
So he's telling a story.
This received critical reception. It was not good. And why do you think that was?
Again, Tanya, it's the same problem. People are not used to certain things. And when they don't get what they're used to, they rebel. And then later on, what they have rebelled against becomes the standard. Well, they said this man needs to stay in the nightclubs. He shouldn't write a 45-minute work that would be premiered at Carnegie Hall. How dare he? He instead should stay in the nightclubs, doing short pieces of jazz music, and be what we stereotype him to be. Anything beyond that is not acceptable.
And now comes probably our most serious attempt, and definitely our longest composition.
Well, let's have our listeners take a listen to the 1943 recording of the first part of Black from Ellington's live performance at Carnegie Hall. Talk to us a little bit about the significance of this today, Black, Brown, and Beige, in this time in history when we're talking and reflecting a lot about issues of race and identity. Seems to be a pretty important work in 2017.
What a prescient question. This is excellent, and thank you for asking it. The importance relates to what the Black community was experiencing at that time. The 1920s and 30s that this piece, even though it was performed in 43, represented. And this is the acculturated Negro. That's the word that I think is most appropriate, because here you have the African-American now excited and expressing his or her own culture. But the importance of that for now is very much related to where we're about to go in our contemporary political experience with the recent election and where things are going to go economically and politically and socially and so on. But I'd like to back up just a little bit because of the civil rights movement. In 1958, he recorded an album with Mahalia Jackson that we just heard Come Sunday from. What's important about that is that that was 58, 3 years after Emmett Till was lynched, was killed, was murdered. And Ellington and Mahalia Jackson in that album were making their contribution in the early stages of the American Civil Rights Movement. What Mahalia Jackson sings is the central lyric, "Please look down and see my people through."
And see my people through.
Now, that's the importance of Black, Brown, and Beige in 58, and it moves forward to us today.
In 2017.
And yes, and one thing that must be understood is that, and I can say this from experience because Ruth Ellington made this point to me. She was my mentor.
And that's his sister, Duke
Ellington's sister. She told me repeatedly, when Maestro Ellington says, "my people," he means all of us. He wants it to be known, and I'm here to say he not only meant the African American, which of course he did mean, but he meant all of us.
Mm-hmm.
This is an interesting point to make on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, this idea of all of us and this idea of music bringing forth that idea in a connective way. You won't be performing Black, Brown, and Beige at the concert here in Boston, but what would you say to folks as they're learning about Black, Brown, and Beige for the first time and maybe pull up some of this music online?
What I would say to them is hear the unique American orchestra, the big band. Ellington's orchestra is a uniquely American entity, musically speaking, and it improvised collectively, and it expressed American culture in a way that no symphony orchestra has. The big band is an American phenomenon.
Because it's a mix of everything that is Americana, is what you're saying.
It's saxophones, trumpets, trombones, and a rhythm section. And it swings. Nothing else does that. You can't do that with a symphony orchestra. Sorry.
Let's hear more from that 1943 Carnegie Hall concert. Here's Beige. What really strikes me is this connective tissue that you have with Ellington's life as a fan, and then the short time that you all worked together. It was really just a short time. But this legacy through his family giving you this gift of saying, we want you to continue to produce his music in this way. Do you feel like it was fate?
Oh, well, I feel like it was a calling from on high. You know, people think in different ways. People could say, well, it was the universe making that happen. Well, I accept that. People could say fate. I accept that. In what I have learned since that happened to me in 1964 and for all of these years since, when I have seen it operating, when I was with Ellington's orchestra, when I was doing this or that or leading the sacred concerts, I've seen that same light. I have to call it a calling from on high.
So in Martin Luther King Day, this idea of social action and that being Martin Luther King's mission and music, that being Duke Ellington's mission, talk about this importance of having and performing the sacred concerts on this day specifically, MLK Day.
There is another very important name which is affiliated with Boston University, and that name is Dr. Howard Thurman. Now, Dr. Thurman is honored in that he was the chaplain of Boston University's Marsh Chapel and was a mentor to Dr. King and was a philosopher, a Baptist minister and a philosopher. There is what is called the Howard Thurman Center for Common Ground. Now, how does that connect? Maestro Ellington, he did his music for all of us, Common Ground. Martin Luther King, who was a protege of Howard Thurman, of Dr. Thurman, obviously a common ground gentleman who said that we are all human beings and that we all will live together as human beings or die together as fools. So the point is, and answering your question, the significance is that we are very much representing humanity as sharing common experience and sharing common ground in our interests, in our gifts, in our outreach to humanity, as opposed to rejecting other people and trying to control other people and oppress other people. So, Ellington, common ground. Martin Luther King, common ground. Dr. Howard Thurman, common ground.
Randall Keith Horton, conductor, composer, and scholar. This was such a great conversation, and I appreciate you for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tanya. All the best to you.
We'll go out today with Praise God, recorded live at Ellington's 1968 Second Concert of Sacred Music. And although today's Boston University concert, conducted by Randall Keith Horton, took place a little earlier this afternoon, there are links to some of the videos of Ellington's original sacred concerts at our website, radioboston.org. That's it for today. I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Radio Boston.